You are listening to the Just Chill Parenting Podcast. I am your host, Rosie Davidson, an infant sleep consultant, author, and mum of three. This is a show all about honest chat where I talk about my favourite topic, sleep, of course, but I will also be covering your burning parenting questions and speak to some very special guests along the way. So buckle up and enjoy! Hello and welcome to the Just Chill Parenting Podcast. This episode, I have the pleasure of hosting the brilliant Karen Gurney, otherwise known as the Sex Doctor. Karen is a consultant clinical psychologist and certified psychosexologist and is a recognised national expert with a wealth of experience and expertise in helping individuals and couples navigate intimacy and relationships. In her NHS work, Karen is the lead psychologist for an award-winning Central London NHS health clinic and has been managing NHS sexual problem services for almost 15 years. With her compassionate approach and wealth of knowledge, Karen brings a refreshing perspective to the complex dynamics of parenthood and relationships. Join us as we delve into discussions about sex, parenting, intimacy, and how not to let kids ruin your sex life with the one and only Karen Gurney.
Hello.
I'm so happy to have you here. I can't wait to talk about this subject because this is the subject when I do Q&As on my social media, people always ask me questions about sex and what's normal and how they can improve things. And I just think you have such an amazing way to help people and reach them. First of all, tell us a bit more about who you are and what you do.
So as you said in the intro, I'm a clinical psychologist, which means that I'm trained in different types of talking therapies and also the application of research into what helps people's lives. And I specialize in anything to do with sex and sexual well-being. So I have been doing that for almost 20 years now in a variety of settings. And for me, a lot of the work that I've been doing throughout my career is around supporting people individually in therapy sessions or perhaps couples in therapy sessions. And it was probably around 7 years ago that I realized all of a sudden that I could have a much wider impact than that and potentially stop people from coming to see me in therapy for the in the first place by getting information out there that people actually need to know, because often people's ideas about sex and how their sex lives should be, the yardsticks that they measure their sex lives by, are actually quite far from what we know in reality their sex lives should be working like. And so I started my Instagram and did the variety of things, the books and the TED Talks, partly just to get that information out there on a wider level, which is why I love doing podcasts like this.
One of the things that I've realized over the years is that sex doesn't actually mean penis and vagina.
Yeah.
And so many of us think that. And when you've had a baby, particularly, you know, you might talk to your friends if you're open enough to have those conversations. Have you had sex yet? Have you done this yet? But what actually is sex? What would you say sex is? How do we define it?
I'm so glad we're starting here, actually, because I totally agree with you. We've all been socialized into an idea that sex is a kind of heteronormative idea of penis and vagina sex. And that's largely based on historical factors, culture, religion, the idea of sex for pleasure as being sinful, sex being about procreation, not necessarily ideas that we'd all sign up for now. You know, a lot of the times we have sex not to get pregnant, although perhaps we'll talk about what happens if you are trying to get pregnant later on. We've been socialized into this idea that sex equals penetration. And even the language that we use backs that up. So we have words like foreplay, which isn't a word I ever use, but is a word that people do use often, which basically implies everything that goes before the main event. So already relegating other types of sex as less than. We've also got words like virginity, which again is another word I don't use, but is really about marking penis and vagina sex as a defining feature of someone's sexual debut. So the language that we use supports this idea, but actually sex is so much more than one sexual act. So I like to define sex as anything that we do with ourselves or with another person that is about our body and our mind that brings some level of sexual pleasure. So that could include solo sex, so masturbation. It could include really hot kissing sessions. It could include other types of sexual touch. It could even include sex where you perhaps don't touch another person, like, you know, phone sex. There's lots of different ways to be sexual. And what's important for people to, I suppose, reflect on is that there's only one function of that penis and vagina sex that you can't get from other types of sex, and that's getting pregnant. But usually getting pregnant is not our motivation to be sexual. Usually our motivation is something else, like wanting to connect, wanting to experience pleasure, wanting to feel close, wanting to cement our relationship or protect the relationship. And many of those other motivations actually aren't best served by penis and vagina sex anyway. So if we look at the fact that, you know, the majority of women, for example, can't orgasm from penis and vagina sex, and then we look at the idea that penis and vagina sex is how we see real sex, in inverted commas, then there's a bit of a mismatch there. And so once we start to open up that idea of what sex is and not really see our sex lives as a kind of on-off switch. So, you know, if we're in a long-term relationship with our partner, you know, we're not having sex until those, you know, 20 minutes when we are having sex. Our sexual relationships don't really work like that. We're being sexual with each other all of the time in the ways that we interact, or perhaps we're not. Perhaps we're not being sexual with each other at all until those 20 minutes come. And then it's really difficult to click into that kind of way of being with each other. So I think it's quite useful to see our sex lives as something which are always around for us. And they're connected to how we speak to each other, how we look at each other, how we compliment each other, whether we have things like passionate kissing in our sex life outside of sex. And these are all things that I call sexual currency. So the kind of sexual charge between us and a partner when we're not having acts of sex together. And they're vital, actually. And they're probably even more vital for parents than any other group.
Often we just don't have the time to create that currency, but we have to kind of make the time. I mean, it makes sense. You can't be expected to suddenly be turned on like 11 o'clock at night when you've just settled your two kids down to bed, you've cleared up the kitchen and you've had no contact other than like sharp words in the kitchen about the dishwasher, and then you're knackered and then you're looking at each other thinking, actually, I can't think of anything worse than touching you at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's kind of what we expect of ourselves, though, isn't it? We expect that, and this is partly because we don't necessarily have all the information we need about how desire works. So in our society, we picture desire as something which we should just have if we love someone, something which should just be present out of the blue for a long-term partner, that we should just feel like having sex. And we know that this, in a long-term relationship, shouldn't be considered the norm, that actually it's normal to feel an absence of that out of the blue desire, and instead for desire to need to be nurtured or kickstarted by something. But as you say, what happens when all the sexual currency gets squeezed out of our relationship, either because we just fall into a culture of not doing it, which is very common in long-term relationships, even for people without kids, or because it's squeezed out of us because of the pressure of other things like having kids and the time that that takes, then we expect ourselves to suddenly be able to relate to that person in a sexual way when we haven't, you know, complimented each other or kissed or flirted with each other for weeks and weeks, and at 11 o'clock at night when we're tired, and when we've got what I call domestic drift, which is just the impact of bedtimes and bath times on your headspace, where you've never felt more in the kind of parenting pit of despair then after that time of night. That's a very difficult time then to suddenly expect to be able to kickstart desire when you've got low levels of sexual currency.
I think a lot of parents as well, by that time, you might actually be physically touched out from your children.
Absolutely.
And I think we often don't consider that. So you might have had a baby on your boob all day, or you've been cuddling a toddler to bed, you know, you've been laying in bed with them, you're almost falling asleep, but you've literally had them hanging around your neck all day. So when you come to approach that with your partner, I think it's so common to feel like, oh, just get away from me. I just don't want that.
Absolutely. And there comes in, I guess, the motivations for if you do feel inclined to want to have some sort of sexual connection with your partner. And perhaps we'll talk about different stages later on in terms of just normalizing that you might not want that for ages, and that's totally fine. Yeah. But if you do feel inclined for that, it's quite useful to reflect on, well, what actually do you feel inclined for? What is the motivation? Because is it that you want to feel actually not like a parent for a second? Is it that you want to feel like you did perhaps before the kids came along, where you want to be seen for other aspects of your identity, and physical touch doesn't come into it at all? You know, what is it that you, maybe you don't want to touch because you have had someone hanging on your body all day, but what else might you want instead of that? You know, what do you want to hear from your partner? What, perhaps you just want a conversation about sex. Perhaps you just want to kiss. Perhaps you just want to hear that they still find you hot. You know, all of these things are about our sex lives. But I often say to people that waiting till, you know, when you've got kids, I think the worst time to have sex is last thing at night. I just think no one's got the energy for it. And to expect yourself to feel motivated to do something that's going to mean you lose even more sleep when you're already tired, I think it's, you're kind of fighting a losing battle. But I think the challenge for a lot of parents is that unless you've only got one child who naps in the day and you both happen to be around during that nap time, what other time do you actually have? And if you've got more than one child, often they don't nap at the same time, do they?
Yeah, exactly.
So time becomes a big challenge and a big barrier for a lot of people. And I actually think that even just acknowledging that in itself is useful for a lot of people's sex lives, because sometimes when I work with parents and they'll say, you know, we're not having sex and we haven't had sex for months and we think we should be having sex. And then it turns out, you know, they've got an 18-month-old and a new baby. And I say, well, when in your week do you think that you should be having sex? Let's actually have a look at your week. When are you alone together without the children when you're not shattered? When does that happen? And they discover there isn't any time, or the time that they do have is a brief 1 hour window after the kids have gone to bed. And in that 1 hour window after the kids have gone to bed, you know, before they get too tired, that's the time when actually they feel that they've got that sense of domestic drift. They're kind of done with the day after bedtime, and they actually just want a bit of time on their own to scroll on the phones or watch TV. And so in some ways that can be quite normalizing for people, recognizing that it might be that the barrier is time, and it's not about you. It's not about your relationship. It's not about your love for each other. It's about the fact that there is no time.
That's so freeing to hear that. And I think for lots of people listening, that will feel quite liberating, because I think we can feel such a pressure, whether that's coming from ourselves or from what we perceive other people to be doing. That if we're not having sex, penetrative sex, three times a week, then we're failing. And it's a reflection of our relationship and how well we're doing and how connected we are. Mm-hmm. Actually, when we recognize that there's these barriers in place, and that's no one's fault, that's just, you know, the nature of having small children. I love that.
It is. And you're quite right about the three times a week thing, because it's what everyone says they think they should be doing. And I have to say that firstly, frequency is a total red herring when it comes to sexual satisfaction. There is no correlation between the amount of sex you have and how good your sex life is. It's actually more about what the sex is like when you have it. So I just want to say that first. But people are often quite drastically wrong when it comes to how often other people are having sex. People are having sex a lot less than you think they are. And we know that in the UK, it's probably more like twice a month for people in the age range of kind of 35 to 45. I suspect that's because that's an age range that often have young kids. Mm. And it's not to say that that's the norm and that's how often you should be doing it. And it's also not to say that it's not okay if you're doing it more than that. But that's often drastically different to what people think. But I suppose one of the key things that I notice a lot in my work is that it is often about the meaning for people, not the amount of sex. And there's an example of a couple I use in the new book, actually, about this. And the book's about kind of sex for parents and how to navigate your sex life. But the example is around a couple where, you know, they've got a new baby. The baby, I think, was about 6 months or a bit older than that, under a year at least. And she's never felt less interested in sex as she is right now. And we all know the reasons, right? It's really obvious that in that time of life, there are plenty of other things that get in the way of feeling like sex. And for her, her motivations to be sexual kind of before the baby came along were often about feeling close to him, having a bit of fun, perhaps about meeting his needs because she knew that he really enjoyed sex and she was happy to do that for the relationship. And none of those needs feel important to her at the moment. You know, she feels really good in the relationship. She feels great as a family of three. She's not interested in putting his needs or obligations high up a priority list right now because she's got other people's needs to think about. And so she's happy for sex to take a back seat, and that's okay for her. But for him, he kind of comes from a family where the narrative in his family was his parents split up because of the pressures of parenting. And this is a time for him of great anxiety because he wants to feel he's just as important to her as he was before. He wants to make sure their relationship still feels good. He loves seeing her interact with the baby and loves watching how close they are, but he sometimes feels a bit left out. And so for him, sex takes on more of an importance. The key thing about these two is that none of it is about actually how much sex they're having. It's all about the meaning that sex brings in their relationship. And when we actually discussed it together as a three, and she learned that actually for him, it's more about him feeling kind of secure in the relationship. And when we talk about when he feels most secure about their sexual connection, he says it's actually not about sex, physical acts of sex. It's about times when, you know, I know that she wants me. It's times when I know she looks at me and she sees me as a sexual partner and not just someone else living in the house. And once we'd got to that stage, it became very easy for them to keep a good sexual connection together without having any more sex, because she was able to find other ways to reassure him in that way. And he was able to back off from feeling like it was all about sex. Sometimes just understanding that for people is really useful, taking the pressure off that they need to be doing anything different at all.
Do you know, one of the things I've heard you say before and really resonated with me is sometimes it can be really helpful to say to your partner, I am too tired to have sex right now. I don't actually want to be intimate. I don't feel like it. But I want you to know that if I wasn't tired, I'd had a really long day, I just spent an hour putting the kids to bed, I would want to have sex with you and I really fancy you.
Yes. I'm so glad you raised this one, actually, because one of the things I wanted to do when I wrote the book is not make this a book about how to have more sex when you're parents, because I actually don't think you need to. I think what you need to understand is what makes a difference to sexual satisfaction, because we know that sex is important for relationships. We know that it has an impact on relationship stability, on psychological well-being, on the risk of infidelity in monogamous relationships. So we know sex is important, but that doesn't mean you need to be having more sex. It sometimes means that you just need to approach sex differently in your relationship. And there's some fascinating sex science about things that improve sexual satisfaction for parents that aren't about having more sex. And one of them is about the way in which we turn each other down. And we know that when you turn your partner down in the way that you've just described now, as opposed to saying, why are you always going on about sex? It's all you ever go on about. Get off me. Instead of that, we know that turning the partner down in the way that you've just described improves sexual satisfaction for both people, not just the person turning down, but the other person as well. And it makes sense because it gives our partner a sense of the meaning behind it. The meaning behind it is not, it's not about you. It's about the fact that I've just got all of tomorrow on the brain. I know I'm going to be up all night with the baby. It's a lovely idea. And I can't wait till we're getting some sleep and we can enjoy and get back to that idea that you've got just now. But right now, I've not got it in me. And that can make a massive difference to relationships to be able to have those types of conversations.
Sometimes I think like talking about what you would do in a scenario if it was different, like, oh, if we had the time, I would love to just lay in bed with you this morning and not rush out and do the school run and get all
exactly
the lunchboxes ready and all the boring stuff we have to do.
Exactly.
I'd love to lay in bed with you all morning and cuddle or be intimate or do whatever and just be with you and smell you and drink you in.
Yes.
And having that conversation just opens it up, I think, and takes away the shame about it might actually be that you prefer to have morning sex, mm-hmm. but that's just out of the question for most families. You want to yeah. wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
That's it. And you know what you've talked about just then, it's that sexual currency. So being able to have that level of communication between the two of you where you say, oh, I wish that we could have a morning again like we used to, where we did X, Y, and Z. I can't wait till we have those mornings back again. You know, I miss those times. I can't wait for that again at some point in the future. That conveys so much about sexual interest, around your attraction for someone, around the fact that sex is important to you in a relationship, but right now it's just not available or less available than it was before. And often when people come to see me for sex therapy, and it's a couple with kids, often one of them will say, my main worry is that sex has fallen off the agenda and it's never going to come back. And that's why they're bringing sex up all the time. That's why they're trying to initiate it. That's why they're saying there's a real problem here. And most people can understand that having young kids, you know, we know that when you've got kids under five, it's a period of lowest sexual satisfaction for couples. So most people get that it's going to be challenging. But what they really need to hear from their partner is, I know it's challenging now, but I am committed for us to get back on track with it at some point. And that can be all it takes.
What about if somebody listening is feeling insecure about their body? Because I think it's important to recognize that as well, because you may find that you have the opportunity at some point, or you're both kind of wanting to be intimate, but a lot of women after birth, whatever birth you've had, mm-hmm. can feel different in their bodies. It's really normal to kind of, your body can feel quite alien, actually, I think, after you've had a baby. You might not feel sexy.
Yeah. And also nobody really warns you about the kind of impact of breastfeeding and what can happen when you get turned on or orgasm and kind of squirts of milk and those types of things. And for some people, I think that's, you know, comfortable and fine and they can kind of laugh it off. And for other people, that's actually feels quite distressing and unusual. So there's lots of body related stuff going on. And as you say, there can also be birth injury, can't there? Both psychological and physical yes. to contend with. You know, the first thing to say is, if we're talking about birthing people here, that actually concern about body image is the number one distractor during sex anyway. And plenty of people will have already had experiences in their life of struggling to get in the zone with sex or enjoy sex or orgasm or feel desire because they're so fixated on how their body looks. And that's a common experience for parents and non-parents. But there is a bit of an adjustment phase and an amplification of this post-birth, isn't there? Because there's a lot of new stuff, you know, new skin, new lumps and bumps, anatomy feels maybe slightly different. And what I notice in the work that I do with people is that often it's the worry about those things rather than those things themselves that affect people's enjoyment of sex. So often people will say, I worry that my partner will not find me as attractive, or I worry that they'll be put off by the fact my body looks different. And that worry is what gets in the way, not the reality of whether their partner thinks that or not. Often the thing that people do is don't mention it to a partner because they almost don't want to draw attention to it, that that the body feels different. So they think, well, I don't want to point it out to them. So I'm just going to keep it to myself. But it's actually in the keeping to yourself that where the worry mounts and where the focus then becomes directed too much on your body during sex. So it is really helpful to talk about that and to say to a partner, you know, I'd really like for us to get back to sex or to have more sex. But if I'm being totally honest, I find it really difficult not to notice how my body's changed. And I worry that that affects you as well. Most of the time, the response from a partner is going to be something like, that's not something I notice, or I do notice your body's changed, but I find it just as attractive as before. You know, those are very common responses that often allay people's worries. So that's usually a great strategy. But also, I think it's really important to be able to communicate about other things that might help as well, because often one of the big things that gets in the way of sexual satisfaction for people is not being able to talk about sex easily. And when you struggle to talk about sex together, it's hard to say things like, actually, it hurts when you touch my breasts or my nipples. So I just want to leave my bra on or my top on. Is that okay? If you can't say those things, then you're not going to be inclined to say yes to sex because you can't communicate the bits that you need to feel okay with sex. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Definitely.
So you might want to leave some clothes on. You might want to have sex, you know, under the covers in bed when perhaps before you're a bit more confident. You might want to have the lights off. There are several things you might find that would help you, but you have to be able to communicate them.
I think the communication's so key. Some women or birthing parents might find that they're not ready for penetrative sex like penis and vagina. Mm-hmm. And they need to be able to communicate that to their partner and say, actually, I do really want to be intimate with you, but can we not initiate this and then have the expectation it's going to end in that? We can do other things. And maybe you need to have that open discourse so that you can explain that. Because I think a lot of women particularly will be reluctant to do anything because they think it's going to end in that. And they might not be ready, like we said, birth injuries, or it's maybe the first time you're having sex after having had a baby. And you're like, I'm actually a bit scared of like, you know, my pelvic floor has been stretched apart and I've had a tear. I've got maybe an anal fissure or piles, all these things that are so normal and common. But you need to be able to have that open discourse, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, communication. You know, if there was one thing that I could change about everybody's sex life that I know would improve the sex lives of the nation, the world even, it would be for us to be able to have freer and easier communication about sex and create a culture in our relationships where we talk about it often, not just when there's a problem, because it solves so many issues. And so much is changing for all of us in our relationships, in our bodies, in our sexuality, as we age. We always need things to be different, actually. We need it to be different to allow growth and flex so we don't get bored of having sex with the same person. And the only way you can do that is by being able to talk about it. And as you say, because we have this cultural idea that penis and vagina is real sex and everything else is just the lead up to it, unless you can actively state otherwise by saying, you know what, I just want you to make me come with a vibrator and then we roll over and go to sleep. Is that okay? You know, clitoral stimulation, that's all I want. Is that okay? Unless you're able to be explicit about that, the assumption that you both have is that it's on this escalator towards something else. And that something else might be the thing that you don't feel ready for. So the easiest thing to do is to say no to it all. You know, a really interesting bit of research that I wrote about in the book is that birthing parents return to masturbation before they return to any other type of sex. So it's not that the kind of desire for sex sometimes isn't there for people a couple of months after birth, but actually the desire for it is, let me have a type of sex that I know isn't going to hurt, that is solely about pleasure, that's going to be quick and time efficient because I haven't got long. And that type of sex is returned to much quicker than sex with partners because there's so much more to navigate. And the way to navigate it is to be able to say, this is what I'd like. This is what I'd feel comfortable with. Can we not worry about penetrative sex for a bit? Because I'm just not exactly sure how I feel about it yet. And I perhaps want to test it on my own a bit before we test it together. And I always advise that's a really good strategy. If people are worried about pain after birth, if they're worried about anatomy, if they're feeling nervous about it, a really good way to overcome that is to practice on your own and see what it's like, you know, with a finger or a small sex toy or something when you're turned on, and just go really slowly just to reassure yourself that it's okay.
I think it can be really hard for birthing parents to get to know their bodies again, and it can feel quite scary. I mean, when you've just... either way you've birthed, whether it's vaginally or a cesarean section, when you look down there, it can look different. It can feel different. You know, your cesarean scar can actually be quite tight. And if you orgasm, it can feel different. There's all these things to consider. And I think you can do other things, maybe even when you're not turned on, just to feel the area. Like you can massage your scar. You can massage sort of the inside of your vagina and kind of feel and like help the skin to kind of to get to know it again. I think there's something in that as well.
just getting more comfortable with your body.
Yeah, for me, certainly, I've had lots of pelvic pain for various reasons. Anyone who's kind of listened to the pod before will know that I've spoken about that, and helping your pelvic floor and things like that can often have an effect on other areas where you're like, actually, I'm comfortable. I know what my body feels like. I can relax this area. Then we can do something together later.
Absolutely. And this is going to sound like an odd thing to say because it goes totally against how our society views it. But I can't stress enough how much this is true. You can have a sex life for the rest of your life that doesn't involve vaginal penetration if you want to. That sex is so much more than that. And people often feel a lot of pressure to return to that and are usually a lot more comfortable after birth with other types of sex, actually, but worried about that one. But it's good not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, just to use a parenting analogy, yeah. Because you can have a sex life and perhaps avoid that bit of it for some time if you want time to adjust to your body and if you feel nervous about it. But don't let that stop you, you know, enjoying a kiss, flirting with each other, saying, oh, when we're getting some sleep, I can't wait to do this. Perhaps having other types of sex if you feel comfortable. Don't let it all fall by the wayside because there's one part of it that you're worried about, because then, you know, you can find yourself a couple of years later finding it quite awkward to relate to each other sexually again after quite a lot of time of just having zero sexual currency between you.
One thing I wanted to touch on before I forget is earlier in the episode, you said percentage of women who don't climax or don't orgasm, sorry, from penetrative sex. I grew up in the 90s and we had, what was it, More Magazine?
More Magazine, I remember it.
We'd all like read it like, oh, what's it going to say about like sex position of the week and all this stuff. But we grew up with this real idea that women could orgasm from penetrative sex. And for me personally, it was only when I was kind of in my early 20s that I realized that I wasn't the only one who didn't orgasm.
It's shocking, isn't it? It's shocking that we're not taught this around our own bodies. And I really hope that we can be the generation that changes this for our children and helps them know more about their anatomy and the pleasure-giving parts of their anatomy. So yeah, we're talking about 20% of women. So a minority of women can orgasm from penetrative sex without any direct, so that's like fingers on or vibrator on, clitoris, or indirect clitoral stimulation, which could be, you know, a body part rubbing on the clitoris at the same time. So just from penetration alone, it's a very small number of women that can orgasm that way. And that orgasm is clitoral stimulation. It's just clitoral stimulation kind of internally. And for some people that works, but for most it doesn't. What I often say to people is, if you think about the way you masturbate, some people don't, but many people do. If you think about the way you masturbate, the types of touch that you enjoy with masturbation, how similar or different does that look to the sex you're having with your partner? Mm-hmm. If it looks quite different, you need to ask yourself why and who's getting more pleasure from that sexual encounter, because we know that more women than men worry about their desire in long-term relationships. And there's many reasons for that, that, you know, we've probably not got time to go into today. Partly it's just normal. But actually, pleasure is a massive reward from sex that helps to keep our desire over time. And so you need both pleasure as an outcome from sex, but you also need sex that doesn't always look the same, because it's a bit like going to, you know, a restaurant and choosing the same meal every time you go and eating it in the same order. You will lose interest in going to that restaurant. And when we have this idea of foreplay that looks like X and Y and then penetrative sex, and when that main course isn't even as rewarding to you as it could be, and perhaps it's privileging someone else's reliable orgasm over yours, that is going to diminish your desire over time. So the more you can diversify the sex you're having, and this is harder for heterosexual couples just because of this idea of what sex is. You don't tend to get this as much with queer couples, where there is less of a set formula. And we know that there's kind of more of an equal kind of orgasm rate between all people.
Yeah.
But it is really important to look at it and say, could we mix it up a little bit and sex not always look like that? Because that doesn't actually always do it for me. And that, of course, is going to put you off doing it. It's going to make it hard, especially for parents when there's other competing priorities? You know, is it going to be sleep? Is it going to be doing the washing? Or is it going to be having a type of sex that I know isn't going to bring me pleasure? And it's hard for sex to rise up the priority list in those conditions.
This episode is brought to you by Just Chill Baby Sleep, their number one infant sleep consultancy in the UK and beyond. We really love sleep and we want you to have all the information that you need about sleep at your fingertips. Our award-winning, self-led online courses can banish those bad nights and leave you feeling calm and in control, and most of all, well-rested. For more information about our online courses and one-to-one support, please go to justchillbabysleep.co.uk. Listeners can also use the code JCPP for 10% off any online course or bundle. So sleep well. Yeah, there was something I did want to touch on with you today, and that was porn and technology. Mm-hmm. So I had a message from a lady quite a long time ago saying, I caught my other half looking at porn and we haven't had sex since having a baby. Mm-hmm. And it really upset me. Do you think that porn can have a real negative impact, or do you think it can ever be positive?
Did she say why it upset her?
No.
No. So it's a really good question. Probably one of the first things to say about porn is that there is a little bit of a moral panic about porn more broadly, and a sense that porn is something which is perhaps harmful or addictive, neither of which are true. And because of that, people often worry about it. And there's also a kind of ethical dilemma to it as well, because not all porn is ethical. And for plenty of women particularly, it's really difficult to resolve that dilemma in your mind if you worry that your partner is accessing a type of porn that isn't ethical. I think the key thing to remember is that, you know, porn has been around as long as humans have, in different formats. So we know that we've always looked at kind of erotic stimulation as something to get us going. And porn is just, visual porn is just the latest version of that. So it's not harmful in its own right. And it's often something that people do enjoy as part of their solo sex. And women enjoy it just as much as men, actually. And it doesn't necessarily mean anything. It's just, this is something that I enjoy watching. I know it's not real. It helps get me turned on. It helps me come. And I find it a bit of fun. And it can be something that people use when they're very happy with the sex in the relationship, as well as something that gets them through times when perhaps sex isn't going as well as they would like. The key bit here is in the meaning of the porn for this person. And which is why I wondered why she was upset about it, because we don't know whether she's upset because she thinks the porn that he's been watching is unethical and that's changed her perception of him and makes her feel really uneasy. I can't stress enough that not all porn is unethical. Or whether it's because she feels that he's pulled away from her and he's choosing this instead of investing in their sexual relationship, and that feels hurtful. Or whether she feels guilty that she's somehow not giving him what he needs and he, inverted commas, has to go elsewhere. But perhaps he's always been watching porn, even when they've been having great sex. So there's something about the meaning here for them to understand. So porn itself is not harmful. We know that there are some things which mean that porn, if people have the same ideas about porn as their partner, they often have higher levels of sexual satisfaction. It can be a challenge when two people have quite different ideas about porn. So someone's quite anti-porn and someone else is quite comfortable with it. That can need talking about and navigating. But what's great about porn, and I'll include audio porn in this, and that's something that's really common with women. So apps, you can get loads of apps now that have got kind of short stories that are kind of designed with women in mind. Audio porn and visual porn are actually really good ways of triggering our arousal and desire. So we know from sex science, they work extremely well to help us have desire feature in our lives. And because we should expect desire in long-term relationships to be responsive, they can be a very time-efficient way for parents to help them get in a sexual headspace. So it's not uncommon for me to work with women who say to me, you know what, I'm motivated to have sex with my partner later today because I just think it'd be a really fun thing to do together. But I know it's hard for me to get in the zone because I've just put the kids to bed and, you know, I've got other things on my mind. So while I have a bath, I'm going to listen to some audio erotica and it's just me time. And it helps me get out of that domestic drift phase and start to connect with my sexuality a bit, which helps me transition more easily into wanting sex with a partner. So for that reason, porn and technology can be a tool that we have at our disposal to support our sex lives.
I love that. Time efficiency.
We need it, right?
It's so hard. I mean, one thing as an aside, working on your child's sleep will help your sex life. I really genuinely believe that. And obviously I'm coming at that from my job.
That's where you come in.
Yeah. I have had parents message me and say, I'm so happy. I can put my baby to bed at 7. We have an evening together. We're able to share a meal together. We're able to have a cuddle again. And we're able to be intimate again because we have the time and the opportunity.
Yes.
It might not be the same, but helping yourself get that time back can be absolutely life-changing. And I know it can be so hard and it's so complex and, you know, every situation is different, but you will eventually get there.
Can we talk about sleep just for a second? Because it's so crucial. So I'm really glad you brought that up. And I know that a while ago, you and I, we talked a lot about a piece of research that came out around how the number of times you get up to tend to your child in the night has a direct relationship on with your sexual satisfaction and the amount of sex that you're having. So this is a crucial bit of information, I think, isn't it? That you know about sleep, that's your thing. But do people know that actually if you're getting up in the night to go to the cot or to go to your young child's bed, if you're getting up in the night repeatedly, don't expect to be able to easily engage with a sex life. Like that's just a normal thing that once you start getting more sleep will return. We know that a poor night's sleep diminishes your chances of feeling able to engage in any type of sex the next day. Sleep is so crucial to sexual response. And when people are in that stage of parenting where they're not getting a good night's sleep or they're up several times in the night, you know, obviously it can be breastfeeding or feeding at different times, my advice to people is please don't worry about sex. Please just focus on getting enough sleep and know that sleep is a big factor in it. But I also say to partners, if you're somebody who's upset about your sex life, but yet you're not the one getting up in the night, then get up more in the night.
Yes, help them.
Because that is going to make a difference to your sex life if your partner gets more sleep.
Yeah. And also sometimes just your partner recognizing that, let's say you're a breastfeeding parent and you kind of almost have to do a lot of it, recognizing how difficult that is. Maybe they say to you, look, I'll try and take the baby and settle them, change their nappy, whatever, even if I then have to pass them back to you to breastfeed them again. Or when we wake up in the morning, even if you can't do it every day that week, a couple of days that week or at the weekend, I will take the baby after you've fed them and you can go back to sleep and I'll bring you a cup of tea and some toast. Like, just make
absolutely
feel like you appreciate them.
I've actually got that tip from you in the book, that tip, because you mentioned that a couple of years ago and I've put that tip directly from you into the book that you know even if they can't do the feeding, they can do the settling afterwards, and that can be a big help. But I think because people don't really understand how desire works, they often find it hard to appreciate the link between things like sleep and sex. They think, well, you should just want to have sex regardless of whether you're tired or not, but it just doesn't work like that. Sleep is crucial to our sexual functioning.
Oh, I love that. Better sleep, better sex.
Indeed. That's why we're a good team, Rosie.
Oh, brilliant team. Another thing I wanted to talk about just briefly is talking to our children about sex. Mm-hmm. Because for so many of us, especially as our kids start to get a bit older and more aware, for example, we were in the kitchen the other day and I was snogging my husband and my eldest walked in, who's about to turn 11, and she was like, oh, you're so gross. but I'm quite comfortable for her to know that, you know, she doesn't know the details, but to know that her mum and dad love each other and mm-hmm. we cuddle and we kiss and that kind of thing. And I think it's important for me to have an open dialogue with her. But how can we approach speaking to our children about sex? And is it important that we're open?
Yes. So it's really important. It's actually so important that it's hard to put into words how crucial it is for the rest of their adult life as well. So if I can just give you a few examples of that. We know that when children receive good sex education, and I'm not talking about, you know, one or two lessons at school, I'm talking about sex education where sex is talked about and revisited often at home. We know that children are more sexually competent when they become sexual for the first time with someone else. So what that means is they are more likely to delay sex until they're really ready for it. They're less likely to be pressured into sex. They're more likely to be able to avoid pregnancy or STIs. They're more likely to be able to center their pleasure and have a good experience. And we know that when your first sexual experience is positive, it has an impact on your sexual function for the rest of your life. So there is so much in the foundations of good sex ed at home. And there are only really a couple of key principles that you need to hold in mind. And maybe I'll just rattle through them if that's useful.
Yeah, go for it.
So the first is accurate naming of body parts and anatomy. So no front bottom or, you know, tuppence words, please. Like, it's a vulva. And there's a vulva, there's a vagina, and it's good to use words for body parts because it's hard when you're an adult if you're trying to have a conversation about sex and the only word you feel comfortable with is tuppence. You know, it's not very easy. So knowing about what body parts are called and what they do is really important. And as people get older, talking about pleasure, this can start from, you know, as young as you like, because, you know, we have conversations all the time with children about their bodies, right? And they can talk about things that feel good. And that's okay. It's important to celebrate pleasure. And it's only later on then you can introduce the idea that pleasure is part of sex as well. And it's not just something you're entitled to, it's something you should expect. Having sex conversations about sex as they get a bit older, that is a bit like you said with your daughter, it's important they know that you have a relationship that exists outside of them. And that you might want privacy sometimes. And that's especially relevant when kids get into their teenage years and parents might need to ask for privacy to be able to have a sex life at all. But yeah. For them, a sense that you have no shame about sex in your family, that you don't see sex as a bad thing, a negative thing, a thing that people shouldn't do with their bodies, but rather something fun, enjoyable, to be celebrated, that can bring pleasure. So if people reflect on their own sex education for a second, they can probably recall that the main message they got about sex, particularly if they're women, was sex is more likely to result in a bad outcome, like reputational damage, pregnancy, pain, something else, than a good outcome. Did anyone our age go into sex thinking the outcome of this is going to be that I'm going to feel great, empowered, that I'm going to have an orgasm, that I'm going to experience pleasure? That's not how it happened. It was what are all the things I need to worry about? And that's not a good start in life for our young people. What we need them to know from a young age is about bodily autonomy and consent. So making sure even before we have conversations about sex with our toddlers or with our 5 and 6 year olds, we need to have conversations about you are the boss of your body. You can tell us what you want or don't want. If you don't want to hug that relative, that's fine. If you don't want to finish everything on your plate, that's fine. You listen to your body and communicate the needs of your body to others, and we will respect that. And then they will learn in turn to do that with others. So bodily autonomy, consent, the fact that pleasure is to be celebrated, not hiding away from words. You know, sex isn't a dirty word. Sex is something that people can enjoy and can be something that they can enjoy when they're older. And just to have those conversations without shame is possibly one of the biggest gifts you can give your child as they emerge into those teenage years and adulthood.
Yeah. Oh, so amazing to hear you say that. I think that's going to really help so many people wondering about how to have those conversations. I mean, we could do a whole other episode on this.
But maybe we should.
Yeah, I have to say, I have had the conversation with my daughter, actually both my daughters, my other one's nearly eight, about you might see something on someone else's phone because they don't have phones. A lot of her friends have a phone. And I think we have to be realistic that they might see porn, or they might, there's actually really likely that they will, or somebody in their peer group may have seen it. They may have shown it to them. And I've had the conversation where I've said, you know, you might see this. If you ever have any questions, you can obviously ask me and tell me, but this is unlikely to be a realistic picture of what sex is.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
My nightmare is for my girls or my son to see this and think that's what sex is. And that's what A, I should be doing, or B, like what's normal.
Yeah. It's not. And it's important to say that porn is only harmful to young people in the absence of any other sex education. So we all learn about sex only from what we see on TV, because without anyone talking about what they actually do or talking openly about how sex works, all we've got to learn from is media. So the way to counteract the stories of porn is to have as many open conversations as you can at home about what sex is, about what it can be, about bodies, about the importance of pleasure, et cetera, et cetera. And then porn has less power, but also to do some porn literacy conversation, a bit like you have, talking about what's not real. And you can start this with younger children before you feel comfortable talking about porn, or perhaps, you know, they're too young to talk about those types of topics. You can start the media literacy, and it's good for social media as well, by just getting them to think about when you're watching, you know, I don't know, a Marvel film on TV or whatever's age appropriate for them, you know, this is really entertaining, this film, isn't it? But how do you think they made that scene? Do you think it's real or not real? Getting them to be critical of what they watch and understand that, you know, that how that was made and the fact that what you're watching isn't necessarily a real depiction of real life. So you can start that quite young, and that's really good for social media because you want to teach them to be critical about that as well. Not everything you see on Instagram is true, but also for porn. But also the message that's key, that sounds like you've given your daughter, is it's really normal to come across this. And as you said, we should expect that our kids have come across this towards the start of secondary school. Most of them will have come across some sexually explicit material, either accidentally or because they were curious and looked it up, or because someone else showed them. And a way to talk about it is to say, you know, there are many reasons why, you know, some horror films are 18. And it's because you might see things that feel kind of hard to watch and maybe make you feel a bit frightened. And there are some films like that about sex as well. And they're not really designed for children, and they can be quite shocking and make you feel quite upset. And what I want you to know is that we will never be angry with you if you've seen something that either you looked up and didn't expect to shock you, or someone else showed you. What we always want you to do is to feel able to come and talk to us. Because it's the shame about sex and porn use that sometimes locks young people into not feeling able to say that they've seen something and it's really upset them. So just creating a culture where we say, you know, we know it's really normal to come across this. Some of what you see might really upset you. Just come and talk to us and we can talk about it together and we'll never be angry.
And people need to know that sex education is not going to make your child have sex really young.
It's the opposite. It's the absolute opposite, yeah, which is why, you know, teenage pregnancy rates in countries with good sex education is quite different than it is in the UK. The irony is that it's not talking about sex that de-skills young people, and then they find themselves in situations where they can't speak up, they struggle to say no, they can't ask for, you know, adequate contraception use. So the more we can talk about those things, we know the better that young people do, and they're actually more likely to delay sex. Not that that's a goal we should be aiming for, but you know, they're more likely to delay their first sex than they are to have it sooner if they have good sex education. Delay it till they're ready is probably the best way to say it.
Oh, I love that. I love that we've spoken about that. I mean, I think we could probably speak all day long, but I wanted to talk a bit about your new book, your previous book, Mind the Gap, which I absolutely loved. But tell us about your new book.
It's called How Not to Let Having Kids Ruin Your Sex Life, says what it is on the tin, Navigating the Parent Years with Your Relationship Intact. And it's basically a book for all parents, whether you are would-be prospective parents, perhaps early on in the parenting journey, trying to conceive or pregnancy. There are chapters on both of those things and sex. Or whether you're in that kind of first 5 years of parenthood, which we know is really the eye of the storm, or for people who feel that they're past those 5 years, maybe they've got several kids and the youngest is older than five, where they feel their sex life has been thrown completely off track by having kids and they want to get back on it. So really when I wrote Mind the Gap, obviously Mind the Gap was about the science of desire in long-term relationships. And there's so much to say about desire in long-term relationships that I got to talk about parenting a bit, but just not really as much as, you know, it kind of needs its own book for some of the reasons we've talked about today. I do have an online course called How Not to Let Having Kids Ruin Your Sex Life. It's very popular. And people were saying, we'd love you to write a book on this. So that's what I've done. But I think the key thing about the book is that I didn't want it to be a book that either was just for women and felt like it was another thing on the kind of mental load checklist, things to do, sort out our sex life. So I wanted it to be a book for everyone, all parents. And also, no matter what your parenting journey is, so, you know, whether you've kind of given birth to parents or whether you've adopted, whether you're a same-sex couple, so it's appropriate for all parents. And the key bit of the book for me is I didn't want it to be anything that would add any extra time to anyone's day. So yes, improving your sex life without having to have more sex is probably the best way of looking at it. And we've talked about some of those aspects today, but there is a lot more.
Oh, I cannot wait to read it.
I can't wait to get a copy to you next few days, yeah. I think.
Oh, amazing. Karen, I just want to thank you for your amazing words of wisdom and your knowledge and your passion for this area. This episode is going to help so many people. If anyone would like to find out more about you generally, where can they find you?
Instagram's the best place. That's where I'm most active. So it's at The Sex Doctor. And I try to do as many free resources and things like that I can over there.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys, for listening. Please remember to review, rate, and subscribe to the podcast. It means the absolute world to have you listening. I'll be back soon with more parenting problems, rants, and sleep information soon. Sleep well.